were undesirable. But the second bill, in the judgment of some, and maybe a majority, was less draconian than the first bill. The reading of the headcounters on the Hill was that there was no question that a names of agents bill was going to pass. It wasn't 51 to 49, it was 91 to 9, that one of these bills was going to pass. And the question was, do you work to achieve the better bill, even though you believe both bills are unconstitutional?
You're listening to Victor Nevasky on Naming Names, The Hollywood Blacklist. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So the people connected with the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for National Security Studies, who have a dual function, they represent defendants in cases where their liberties are being violated, and they bring appeals to the courts, they represent the nation in some cases. They also are lobbyists against legislation that they feel violates the Bill of Rights, on behalf of legislation that they feel improves the climate for the exercise of our rights and liberties. They chose to speak against both versions of the bill, but to work behind the scenes on behalf of the lesser evil bill. And they were meeting simultaneously with a larger group of people, some from a place called the Center for Constitutional Rights, that are more radical and less libertarian, including people like Bill Kunstler and the Ratners and others, and other groups, some of whom felt, someone used the analogy of, if a bill is unconstitutional, it's like being a little bit pregnant, you cannot then work for its passage. And to do so merely confuses the educational process, which is the important thing, and in the long run undermines your credibility with the constituency that's most important, which are the rest of us who are out there. In addition, then you get down to the little nitty things. This group was meeting to exchange ideas on a weekly basis, but they had not agreed that they were going necessarily to take votes and work together. They're just meeting. And so when the ACLU people would have a meeting scheduled with the CIA to get the CIA, which was sympathetic to the lesser evil bill as it happened, to work with the people on the floor to put through the lesser evil bill, they didn't share that with the larger group. The larger group felt, you guys are meeting secretly with the Central Intelligence Agency. See what this has done? And, well, that kind of argument, I mean, you know, I think ultimately it may well be that it's wrong for one organization to try to do both those things. It can't do both of them well. The trouble with that argument, with what I just said, is, as Mort Halperin will say to me, that's all very well and good for you to say, but who's doing it? There's no one else doing it. And this week, maybe next week, you can organize one to do it, but no one else is doing it. So I would have voted not to work for the lesser evil bill myself, but it's not an issue that I'm confident history has an easy answer for. I don't think that you can make a one-to-one judgment there. I think that the ACLU made its judgment in good faith. As it turned out, it didn't do any good. They didn't get the lesser evil bill, so it looks better for the other side. But again, that's easy to say in retrospect. I think there is one thing that I think is a general lesson to be learned from the past for both the left and the kind of libertarian communities, which I make a distinction between. That is, and for the center liberals, it seemed to me that there were a group of liberals epitomized by people like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and the ADA Nexus, who understood the nature of Stalinism better than those to their left, who understood the nature of McCarthyism perhaps as well as those to their left, and yet whose response to the phenomenon of McCarthyism was destructive to their values because they abandoned those to their far left. And their response was better, from my point of view, than William F. Buckley Jr.'s, and it was better than many who tried to pretend that it didn't exist. But it ended up by saying that, in effect, everybody, that guilt by association is an evil system, except when you're dealing with real communists, you're destroying the principle that you're supposed to be upholding. The American Civil Liberties Union itself, in those years, excluded known communists from their board of directors, kicked off Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who had been elected by their members because she was an open member of the Communist Party. That experience, it seems to me, says to me that one of the lessons of that period is that the center liberals in time of trouble or repression should protect rather than abandon those to their left, because ultimately they'll be protecting the principles that they really are committed and values that they really are committed to, whatever the short run gains or losses might be. The second lesson of the period for me is for the Marxists. The Marxists really had, or not all, but the communists, start with the Communist Party, had no real faith in the freedoms encoded in the Bill of Rights. And so they used the courts and the educational process not to educate people on the nature of our Bill of Rights, but really to do something else. And they basically, I think, in some part of their genes, believed that the Constitution is a bourgeois phenomenon, and it's an instrument by which the ruling class keeps peace among the masses. There were some, like one of the lawyers for the Ten, a fellow named Martin Popper, who I believe is a Marxist, he would have to tell you that, but also I believe is committed to the First Amendment, and who took the First Amendment when he appeared before the committee himself, and believed in it, but many didn't. And I think the lesson for the community of Marxists is that the civil liberties are important, and you got to have both, and it's you got to have democratic values as well as socialist ones, and that maybe you can't have one without the other in resisting that kind of an assault on values.
Ronald Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild during much of the McCarthy period and the HUAC period that we've been talking about. How was he influenced and affected by what happened?
Well, you know, Reagan in 1980 was asked by Robert Scheer, who was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, a question about what was happening in Hollywood during that time. And Reagan said, there is no such thing as a blacklist. There was no such thing as a blacklist. If there was any blacklisting, it was blacklist by communists to keep out those who didn't agree with them from their films. Whatever way in which he was influenced, he has, I don't think he's lying. I don't think he's consciously lying. I think he has suppressed his knowledge of what went on, and I think he is reflexively doing what the vast majority of people in the industry in those years did. They all denied that there was a blacklist. They all said they wouldn't be party to a blacklist. And my joke about it is they say, there is no such thing as a blacklist. That's a rumor that's being perpetrated by people who can't get jobs because of their political histories and commitments. In that respect, it seems to me, he was a representative and is a representative figure, that it's possible to go along with something and not realize what you're doing. And he signed in that period a letter to, as president of the Screen Actors Guild, to Gail, to the wife of Herbert Biberman, who was one of the Hollywood Ten. She used to play all of the Spider-Woman in all those movies, Gail Sondergaard. And she wrote, when she was called before the committee, and asked for the support of her guild to resist the committee when she was supposed to appear. And she asked the guild to take the position, in effect, that if any producer refused to hire her as a result of her resistance of the committee, that the guild denounced the producer, and perhaps even she didn't ask this, but my own belief is if the guild had said, if you blacklist one of our members, none of our members will work for you, they might have broken the blacklist. In any event, he wrote back to her saying that it was a position of the executive board of the guild that they could not tell a producer to hire an actor whose political activities were so controversial that they might interfere with the box office, and besides any patriotic American or to cooperate with a duly authorized committee of the Congress. So he went along just a few weeks ago in informal conversation or in a press conference. He let slip the idea that the nuclear freeze movement itself was, or the leaders of the freeze movement or the members of the freeze movement were dupes of some unnamed conspiracy.
To weaken America.
To weaken America. The State Department had put out some papers that were reflected in an article that appeared in the Reader's Digest by John Barron, suggesting that a lot of the people in on the organization of the Freeze are KGB agents or dupes. Interestingly enough, John Barron was mentioned in the New York Times in the 1960s as someone who the CIA used to put out information through. So who knows where the truth lies.
On October 6th, there was an editorial in the Washington Post that described the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which is one of the most active groups for the Freeze, as a Soviet front.
Right, and the Women's Strike for Peace, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you were talking about the two...
The Post followed that up with a retraction of their editorial about a few days later. It may be an unprecedented thing for it to have done. They got so much flack on it, and it turned out, you know, they were relying on a government document, and the State Department is putting out this tripe. And that has echoes of some of the things that were happening in the 50s. It's not the same thing. It's different. I think there are worse things happening now than happened then. But some of it is the same.
When you were talking about the two bills that Congress was dealing with to prevent people from naming names of agents, and then the debate which ensued among the left, I couldn't help but extend that into an analogy of Republicans versus Democrats. And when I say Democrats, I'm thinking mostly about the neoliberals who were advocating leaving the corporate state to its own devices to succeed in the world, and we'll just take care of everyone who's been alienated and put out of work by a huge welfare system. When you had said about the two bills that you wouldn't have supported either one, can we extend that to perhaps the Democrats and the neoliberals being the lesser evil in the elections coming up next month and next couple of years? Can you talk about the neoliberal threat if you see it as that?
Yeah, well, I think you have to look at each of these things case by case, okay? So, and even the word neoliberal, it's a very slippery one. It's used to include people like Colorado Senator Hart, Senator Tsongas, Robert Reich, who was a economist and political scientist, who writes for The Nation, The Republic, and elsewhere. Thoreau, another Harvard economist. Economically, they appear to have in common a notion that not that you let private enterprise solve things by itself, but that private enterprise, government, and the trade unions have to work together to develop an investment policy to... And then some of them then say to move us out of, I think today or yesterday somewhere, to move us out of sunset industries like steel and into sunrise industries like high tech. And others have different views about how it should be done. The birth of the term neoliberal happened shortly after Reagan was elected and a lot of liberal senators were knocked off. And unfortunately, it took on the appearance because a number of members of the Senate, Tsongas being the most, I think, articulate of them, but Hart a little bit, said things that sounded like, well, the Democrats have gotten a message from the people that we can't give real alternative ideas anymore. We have to speak in a language that they understand, meaning that Reagan and the new right did speak in that language. So it sounded like it was they were going to try and create some new thing in between the Kennedy updated New Deal Great Society Democratic program and the Reagan right-wing Republican program. In fact, they appear economically to stand for something quite different than that. They're trying to work out an economic orientation for our time. The problem is, to me, that none of the so-called neoliberals who I've heard, any more than the Kennedy Democrats, have really addressed what a writer named Alan Wolfe describes in his book America's Impasse to be our problem, which is, he says, what is economically necessary is politically impossible. And that, you look at the four main areas of causes of consumer inflation, food, fuel, health, and housing. And each of those areas is dominated by an industry, and that, with the exception of housing, which is directly tied to the interest rate structure, the way to get at those areas, whether in terms of prices, in terms of distribution, in terms of production, is not through the old fiscal and monetary jiggling around, that you really have to restructure each of those areas, and that requires, again, each one has different requirements. In food, you may want to have regional co-ops. In energy, you may want to have some forms of public ownership and other things. Those solutions are not within the foreseeable realm of political possibility in this country. So, to me, it's very important that economists and magazines like The Nation explore those alternatives in as serious a way as we can. But when it comes to pulling down the lever on November 4th, you got to look at who's running there and make a decision. It's related to that, but that's not the only thing it's related to. So, for example, last time, during the presidential election, we urged our readers to vote to stop Reagan. And what we said was that vote your conscience where you can and against Reagan where you must. I mean, in other words, if the only way you think you can stop him is by voting for Carter, vote for Carter. If you're in a state where, in your judgment, there's no question, either Carter's got it or Reagan's got it, then vote the Citizens Party, or vote David McReynolds, or vote the Communist Party, whatever you want to do. But it wasn't, the national election is not the place to look in talking about these questions, because that's a little bit further down the road. May not be as far down the road as we all think, just as the new right helped put a president in after, for 16 years, being a kind of an oddity that would pop up in magazines like National Review and Human Events and in bizarre foundations, but never really appeared to be part of the political process. All of a sudden, it emerged, and it may be that a similar thing will happen, but we can't know that.
Dave Dellinger's version of the lesser of two evils is the evil of two lessers. How would you assess the fact that with each succeeding presidential election, fewer and fewer voters are participating, and what does that augur for the future?
Well, I was interested to see this time, for the first time, that and I haven't seen the final figures, but I know in New York the number of black and minority voters went way up in the primary, which I think is a terrific thing. And I'm told that it's not just a New York phenomenon, that the primary figures are still coming in, but that it was a nationwide thing. It seems to me that when the initial analyses of the 1980 elections came in, it was portrayed as a, quote, landslide victory and as a triumph for the new right. And I didn't read it that way. It seemed to me knocking off specific senators like Senator Church and others was a triumph for the technology that the new right had gotten hold of, being able to target single-interest constituencies through direct mail campaigns, through the vigory direct mail machine, and that's how they were able to knock off senators on issues like capital punishment and abortion. But that the Reagan victory itself, when you look at the numbers, as you point out, something like 49% of the people didn't vote, which means that Reagan's landslide consisted of 26% of the eligible voters. In my judgment, half of those were anti-Carter votes, and which leaves him with 13%. And in my judgment, half of those are people who like Reagan, which leaves him with about 7.5%. Now you have 50%, 51%, 49% sitting out there who didn't vote. And those are the young, and those are the poor, and those are the minorities, and those are the alienated. And it seems to me the challenge to the, whatever you want to call it, the progressives, the liberal left, the outsiders, now is to be able to articulate a program, to imagine and articulate a program that speaks to the needs of the trade union movement, people who the so-called hard hat constituency, in terms of their own interests, and that energizes this 49% to come out, because that's really, they have an interest in common. And whether it's worker ownership, worker control, democracy in the workplace, or some variant of some of the so-called neoliberals' economic program as distinguished from its foreign policy program, no one has put it together yet. I don't believe that whoever does put it together is going to be the presidential candidate. Usually the candidate discovers ideas that other people have come up with and kind of imports them into his program, and as with Franklin Roosevelt, imports them into his post-election program. So how it happens, in which order, we can't know, but I think that's what has to happen.
You were just listening to Victor Navasky on Naming Names, The Hollywood Blacklist. I interviewed him along with S.K. Levin of the Colorado Daily in the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. This never-before-broadcast program from the AR Archives was recorded in 1982. Victor Navasky was the longtime editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. In 1982, his book Naming Names about the Hollywood Blacklist won the National Book Award. He died in January 2023, at the age of 90. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Victor Navasky on Naming Names, The Hollywood Blacklist, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the great tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins playing the Freedom Suite. Thank you.
Black is like the magic, the magic's like a spell. My brothers went to heaven, the police going to yell, they're going to hello, operator, emergency hotline. If I say that I can't breathe, will I become a jar? Line up to see the movie, line up to see the act. The officers are scheming to cover up their cover up their ass. Ask me no more questions, tell me no more lies. You're serving and protecting, is stealing babies' lives. I'm very black, 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 yes.
Mantra says guillotine, missionary commission, misery into angel wings. And all he wanna do is be still and cut bread. Never know the dead how they whisper, forgive me. Everything is relative, politicize the evidence. I heard a politician reiterate all the messages. And all he wanna do is feed family, be famous. Never know the poor how they scream out, redeem me. Everything is casualty, a song I heard the bullets sing. I know a couple babies gon' see him fly tonight. Wish he wasn't magic. All he wanna do is be a passage in the book titled America the Savage. Symphony and symphony, when everything was meant to be. Piano manager, my boy just invented the song for me. And all I wanna do is find love and be happy. And all I wanna do is find love.
I'm very black.